even met Jose. Is he here?
Yeah, he's supposed to start to he's here.
He had like 300 emails.
I know.
He hadn't checked in the bus like 4 days, and he had like...
You know, I'd be so grateful if I only got 300 emails in 4 days.
Me too.
I did that about 12 hours.
Right.
He was just sitting there on the phone and on the computer at the same time. Like,
yeah. Oh, it's terrible.
It's killing us. I hang out in high school. I know how to do house sweeps. Hi, everybody. Welcome to, what is the number of this session? Anybody remember? 4373. And this is a session sponsored, co-sponsored by the Labor Caucus and the Peace Caucus, both of which you are heartily encouraged to join. We have Patrice Sutton and Pamela Wilson over there by the door with information on how to join each of those caucuses. Patrice, here's my entry and my check if you want to pick that up. Okay, good. We have... In your book, I think you saw that there are four speakers for this session. There are actually going to be five, and one of them is switched out for two, so just bear with us as we walk through all this. So I'm going to start with the first paper. My name is Amy Hagopian, and I'm on the faculty in the School of Public Health at the University of Washington, where I earned my doctorate. And I lead a sister university project there with the University of Basra in Iraq. My particular research interest area is migration of health professionals from poor countries to rich countries, but that's not what this is about today. What this is about today is my experience as a PTA member in my kids' high school. My children attend Garfield High School in Seattle, Washington. My third one is a senior there now. Two of them have graduated, and I'll tell you a little bit more about that high school later. Okay. I'm going to have to push these buttons here because I had a Macintosh conversion issue. Anybody have those issues? Okay. Joseph Stiglitz wrote a book called The $3 Trillion War, in which he explained that the military recruiting budget has skyrocketed for four reasons. One is more recruiters and the cost of supporting them and their travel. Two is higher and more recruitment bonuses. Three is big payments to Madison Avenue firms who are creating these recruitment campaigns. And four, outreach to influencers like me, parents and teachers. None of that money, however, came to me. Section 9528 of the No Child Left Behind Act was added to the law after military recruiters said they were meeting stiff resistance during recruiting in a number of schools nationwide, particularly high schools. Rod Page, who was then Secretary of Education, and Donald Rumsfeld, who was Secretary of Defense, sent this letter encouraging the measure to pass. They wrote, "The support by our nation's educational institutions on behalf of the U.S. Armed Forces is critical to the success of an all-volunteer force." No Child Left Behind requires two things of schools. First, they have to turn over all their student contact information to various military recruiters each fall, unless parents have specifically requested that their kids' names be left off. And second, if a high school allows any college or career recruiters into their buildings, it must also allow military recruiters, that is, public high schools. Private high schools, of course, are exempt. The 2009 Department of Defense budget proposal for recruiting was $20.5 billion. So that's nearly double the expenditure in 2008, and in 2003 the budget was only $4 billion, so that's a 500% increase in 5 years. And as a result, there is always plenty of money to support helicopter visits to high schools, big vans that travel around to high schools, free video games, giveaways, water bottles, gizmos, and of course climbing walls. This particular climbing wall appeared at the University of Washington campus last month, but after it was scaled by an anti-war protester, it mysteriously disappeared. There's nothing the recruiters won't do to get near a kid. This is a military convoy truck carrying high school cheerleaders onto their football field. Recruiters volunteer to teach gym in cash-strapped school districts. They chaperone dances in their uniforms. They ride public buses in the morning to sit next to kids. They volunteer to tutor the Hispanic Study Club members in my kids' high school. About 3 years ago, one of Seattle's favorite columnists wrote about a single mom who lives about an hour north of Seattle who had a horror story about the recruiters. And the story went that her son's father, who was a Marine Corps vet who served in Vietnam and died when the boy was four, and her son, when he reached high school, became the target of recruiters. So they told her 17-year-old son, "You don't want to be a burden to your mom, be a man. Make your father proud." And the next thing this kid knew, the recruiters showed up at the restaurant where he worked and whisked him away and took him to a hotel in Seattle. And at 3:30 in the morning, he was awakened and made to fill in forms and take tests, and he was signed up for the military. And this is a not uncommon story. There are many recruiter horror stories, which I'm not going to go into because that's not the purpose of this talk, but they're readily found. And so the behavior of military recruiters towards children might even remind one of the grooming behavior of predators. Part of the recruiting budget is used to print full-paged ads in high school student newspapers. Here's an ad that appears regularly in Seattle high school papers. The Army Advantage Fund is an important recruiting tool because it promises money to buy a home or start a small business. The bonuses are scaled to the amount of time spent on active duty. You can make up to $40,000 for 5 years of duty as assigned. And you don't get the money until you finish your commitment. McCann Erickson is the advertising firm that's preparing these and other ads to promote that. And they have a pilot program in 5 cities, of which Seattle is one. The high school that my 3 kids have attended is an inner city Seattle public high school. It has about 40% white students, 25% black, 25% Asian. It has a history of progressive political activity. Stokely Carmichael spoke there in the 60s. And it's the starting point for the Martin Luther King March in our city every January. In the fall of 2002, our PTSA passed a resolution opposing any invasion of Iraq, stating the lives of the young people we graduate from this institution are valuable and precious to us. The financial costs of fighting a new war will come from resources better spent improving the quality of education for our children and advancing their opportunities for higher education. So that was the fall of 2002, before the invasion. Well, I know this is going to shock you, but they didn't listen to the moms and dads at Garfield High School. So we invaded in March of 2003, and finding volunteers to go to that war got tougher, and so recruitment efforts in the high schools really escalated across the country and in Seattle as well. Our PTA held an informational forum on the issue of recruiting in schools, and then our board and general membership approved a resolution opposing in-school recruitment. I was PTA president at the time, and so I became the spokesperson for this policy position. I sent out a press release announcing our decision. The day after the resolution passed, our lunchroom was, as usual, overflowing with recruiters and their tables. Why do you suppose they like the lunchroom so much? That's where they typically set up if they get a chance. Pardon?
Do they provide?
No, they provide a lot of toys and games. So the reason they set up in the lunchroom is because that's where the kids on free and reduced lunch eat. Everyone else goes somewhere else to eat. We went to deliver a copy of our resolution to the recruiters in the lunchroom and to inform them they were no longer welcome at our high school, even though they had a legal right under No Child Left Behind to be there. Since I had sent out a press release, the newspaper reporters were there to cover the confrontation, and this appeared on the front page of our Seattle newspaper. The news coverage after that was really incredibly overwhelming. We were on German television, several Japanese newspapers, the New York Times twice, including the front page, wire services, National Public Radio. I got to be interviewed by Joe Scarborough. Anybody listen to that incredible show? lots of right-wing radio, some of it incredibly creepy. I was accused of being in bed with Saddam Hussein. I had to laugh. I said, I'm a PTA mom. We even made Democracy Now!, which was my personal favorite, and then my email exploded with both positive and negative messages, some of it with long-term career consequences for me, actually. We had to decide where to go next with this, though, because No Child Left Behind wasn't going to change. And we decided as a next strategy, we would ask our Seattle School Board to take as strong a policy position as it could on recruiting in schools within the bounds of the law. So we drafted the policy for them. We worked with a couple of progressive members, and they adopted a very protective policy, limiting access for recruiters to twice a year, and they couldn't really restrict it further without also restricting access to college recruiters, and we didn't want that. As I explained, it's No Child Left Behind that requires recruiters be allowed access to schools. Parents and even students themselves, however, can opt out. That is, sign privacy protection forms that hold back their contact information from the database that's sent to the military every fall. Those opt-out provisions are in No Child Left Behind, as well as the general federal privacy laws. Unfortunately, many school districts don't tell families that they have this opportunity, and those that do use the opt-out punitively. That is, if you opt out, you also won't get college recruiting materials, you can't be in the family directory, you're restricted from having your picture in the yearbook. So there's many school districts who just aren't putting this together in a reasonable way. So our PTAs have then worked with counter-recruiting activists in the peace movement in Seattle to use the opt-out process as a recruiting tool. We typically have tables at high school open houses in the fall. We stand by the buses as students get off, and we've gotten words out in PTA newsletters and student newspapers. This, for example, is an ad we placed in our own student newspaper in opposition to the full-page ads that the Army had. In Seattle, we've steadily increased the proportion of students opting out since we started our efforts in 2004. This graph shows it's each high school, and progressively the opt-out rates in each school have gotten higher. The one all the way over on the left is Garfield with the highest opt-out rate in the city. Students in Seattle have also led anti-war walkouts of the high schools each fall for about 3 years now. There's something called the Delayed Entry or Future Soldier Program. Anybody heard of this program? Okay. So in this program, you can enlist underage kids on a provisional basis. And although the regulations say that kids can get out before they reach 18 or when they reach 18, often they are manipulated in various ways into staying. The GI Rights Hotline reports increasingly aggressive recruiters try to intimidate kids into staying in. At our high school, we had one 17-year-old kid who took the summer off after junior year to go to boot camp with the expectation he would come back to graduate, and he never returned. Fox News, always a reliable source, reports there were 3,350 schools with junior ROTC programs in 2006 with over 500,000 kids enrolled. It's not technically called recruitment, but obviously the military presence in schools creates a pro-military culture, and it's been estimated that about a third of ROTC enrolled kids end up in military service. Instructors are retired officers who have served at least 20 years. They wear their uniforms in school, and they receive a salary equivalent to the difference between their retired pay and their active duty pay. And this difference in pay is supposed to be at least half picked up by the school districts. So junior ROTC costs school districts quite a bit of money. This is a photo somebody sent me that's from San Diego just last week. This is their Education Not Arms Coalition, and they succeeded in stopping involuntary placement of students in junior ROTC. Students must also be informed that ROTC classes don't count towards college admission credit, and that PE credit will not be awarded any longer for junior ROTC classes in the future. Their next goal is to start working on weapons training that junior ROTC does in the schools. Another recruiting tool is the Armed Forces Vocational Aptitude Battery Test. The ASVAB is given at over 14,000 schools and is developed and maintained by the Department of Defense. It's sold to the schools as a general aptitude test, but it's clearly a recruiting tool. And it's worth more attention, I think, by the counter-recruiting community. Parents need to know when their kids are taking this test and that they can opt out of having their scores sent to the military. Seattle has a very progressive counter-recruiting policy, actually dating back to 1991, which is when I was on the school board and introduced this policy. And it states that when high schools permit military recruiters to speak with students regarding military career opportunities, the schools must provide equal access for organizations that wish to counsel alternatives. Quaker House in North Carolina puts out a line of counter-recruiting information that is clearly appealing to young people and informs them in detail about what might be lurking in military enlistment contracts that they might not have been informed about. Washington Truth in Recruiting seeks out opportunities to get in touch with school board members. Here's a table that we put up every year at the annual school board member convention. And similarly, we've worked with school district counselors regarding their role in providing alternatives to military enlistment. Literature display in school counseling offices, they always have lots of material. California Representative Mike Honda has a Student Privacy Protection Act, which is an amendment to No Child Left Behind that would convert the opt-out to an opt-in. That hasn't gone anywhere, but as No Child Left Behind gets reformed in the new administration, we're hoping that will proceed. We also tried to use his opt-in legislation as an organizing tool with our state PTA. We were successful after 3 years of trying to work it through our state legislative assembly in getting some support for that. But state PTAs are notoriously very conservative entities, tending to be dominated by elementary parents who aren't really in touch with this issue. It's important to warn parents that opting out of the school district data set sent to the military will not ensure they are not pursued by recruiters. The Defense Department contracts with privacy firms like one called Teenage Research Unlimited that combs all sorts of public and private databases for information on recruiters. This is, for example, just the set of mailings I've gotten in the last couple weeks for my daughter, if anybody wants to look at this. My friend Kathy Barker was featured in this week's issue of Seattle's Alternative Weekly Paper for trying to keep city parks free of military recruiters. The city parks department is inviting recruiters to the teen fairs. The agenda for counter-recruiters in the face of an all-volunteer army is long. The real battleground is in the rural and low-income suburban school districts. Students need to be more involved in these efforts. Vietnam-era parents are currently in the forefront, and really it should be the kids who are leading this. School board members need to see that it's their job to protect student interests, and counselors need to offer alternatives to kids looking to pay for college. Teachers' unions in some places have shown some leadership, but they could do more. Washington recently launched a college-bound scholarship program for low-income kids, and in my high school, we organized something called College Access Now that employs AmeriCorps volunteers to work with kids on filling in their college applications, studying for SAT, getting scholarships to go to school. There are lots of resources, let me just say that being engaged in the military recruitment issue has been really good for our PTA at Garfield High School. We brought in a number of non-traditional parents to get active in PTA who were beyond the bake sale set. We're now raising about $300,000 a year in our PTA, and it goes for things like literacy and that College Access Now program I told you about. I think because PTA is such a mainstream organization, that's why it was so newsworthy when we took the stand against recruiting. And I encourage people to use their very mainstream organizations that they're probably members of as ways to advance peace and social justice movements. Okay. And I'm going to leave this slide up. Thank you. So that you'll be taped when you talk, even though you don't have slides. Okay? So next I want to introduce, pardon me? I could. Okay. Next I'd like to introduce Elizabeth Stinson. She's a longtime human rights activist and has been director of the Sonoma County Peace and Justice Center since November of 2001. In this work, she assists individuals to leave the military and works with local high schools to provide youth with alternatives to joining the military. For her commitment to social justice work, Elizabeth is the 2006 Long Haul Peace Prize Award winner from the Agape Foundation and the 2008 Jack Green Civil Liberties Award from the ACLU of Northern California. She's a licensed marriage and family therapist who specializes in PTSD and trauma relief. She reports that 2 weeks ago, her agency surpassed 1,000 discharges. She works closely with Iraq Abets Against the War, and she gives psychological support to the active duty military personnel seeking discharges. She's also attended the Winter Soldier hearings, which you'll hear more about later, and she arrived here straight from the Human Rights Conference in El Salvador, where she testified about PTSD coming back from Iraq along with other members of the IVAW. Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Amy, for that wonderful presentation on counter-recruiting. First, I should tell you briefly that I'm Anishinaabe. I'm from a tribe in Canada, and I was raised by a collective of tribes. I've been adopted by 4 different tribal nations, so I was kind of raised a little differently than many people because I was always told you always look 7 generations behind and 7 generations ahead in every decision you make. And I would so wish that on any new administration that we get after this next election. And I'm very honored to be here with IVAW members and with Michael and Amy. Thank you for inviting me. When I took over as director of the Peace and Justice Center of Sonoma County, it was November of 2001, and the peace movement was very shaken because we were headed towards moving into the occupation, the invasion of Iraq. And everybody was feeling kind of polarized and like they were the wrong color. And it was the country was capitalizing on that in many ways. It was very unfortunate. And so for me, I was coming from international human rights work, and I saw the potential for many human rights abuses if we didn't be really aggressive, and I didn't know which way to go with it as an organizer and as a national, really on the national level. So I was trying to do something regionally. And as a marriage and family therapist, I knew that if you can get one person within the system to react differently than the expected response, that the whole system is capable of shifting. So I would hold that in my heart and go, okay, I really need to work with this. So I decided to work one person at a time and start to do military discharges. I had done two as liaison to UNPO for the Lakota, Dakota, Nakota, the Sioux Nation. And both of those had involved grandmas who had called me from Pine Ridge, South Dakota, and spoken Lakota to me. And I had to look up everything they were saying, and they were pretty unbelievable stories. But one of them, the grandma kept calling me back and calling me back, and she was telling me that her grandson was being held captive on a ship in San Diego. And I live up in the Bay Area, and I listened to her over and over, and I'd look up words, and I'd call elders on the reservation, and I'd say, does this mean this? Is she really telling me that he's lost his mind and that he's chained up in a ship and that he doesn't know who he is? And they'd say, yes, that's what she's telling you. And so finally I couldn't determine anymore what I could do from the Bay Area. So I got on a plane and came down here to San Diego. I went to the ship that he was on and I asked if I could board. And because they didn't know who I was, they said, sure, come on aboard. And they let me on the ship, and they took me down and showed me where he was. And indeed, he was chained at the bottom of a boat, and he had lost his mind. And so I had looked at, he had a large scar on his head, and I said, can we unchain him and move him away from these hot pipes? And so they unchained him and moved him like 10 feet from where he was chained near kind of a kitchen area, I guess they'd call it. And within minutes, he was making sense again and able to kind of re-enter his body and knew who he was. And what had happened was he had gotten in a fight. He had had a surgery. There was a metal plate that was placed in his head to protect part of his skull. And when he did his job in the kitchen, the metal plate would heat up and he would go kind of crazy because he was so uncomfortable. And because he kept leaving the area where he was supposed to work, they chained him so that he would quit disobeying the order and leaving the area. Well, they actually weren't as merciless as it sounds, because they did try all these different things and they were unaware that he was so uncomfortable. They did think that he was just losing his mind, and they kept having doctors come and look at him. Well, once I explained to them that under the Department of Defense directives, he actually qualifies for medical discharge, they were able to release him. And that was the only discharge really experience, except for a hardship case that I had in 2001. And what happened was I put up a link on our website, and I went to my board of directors that was just frightened by having hired me. They were used to office managers and not activists. They didn't know what to do. They felt like I'd staged a coup and taken the center over, because we had a lot going on there. And so I went to them. I said, I want to do demilitarization work, and I want you to back me up on this. And they said, oh, we're decades from that, and we don't really understand what you mean. And I said, well, if we're counter-recruiting in the schools and we're doing good counter-recruitment, then our next step is to actually help people who've been recruited obtain a discharge, and the best possible discharge. And so they said, oh, well, whatever, go ahead. We don't know, you know, how this is going to fly. And at that time, I was making a lot of public statements as we organized about the upcoming resistance, if indeed we did invade Iraq. So I was getting a number of death threats in Sonoma County, and threatens to the building in which I worked. And my poor volunteer staff was pretty horrified when they would come in and pick up my messages. So at that time, things hadn't really heated up. They hadn't gotten really bad. And what I decided to do was to put a link on our website and say that basically says, get out of the military. need information, click here. And that would come to me, and then I would do a kind of a simple intake interview and ask them questions. And I started getting a lot of people that were in Afghanistan, a lot of people that were then in Afghanistan, including Colonel Ann Wright contacted me at one point. And we had a lot of people from that were in Okinawa, some people in Bosnia, and a lot of people in different states in the U.S. contacting us, asking us questions about the different discharge criteria. And so we started to kind of, there were three women that were very committed to doing this, and we would download the DOD directives, Department of Defense directives. We would take them home and basically fall asleep with them over our heads and reading, trying to read this stuff and make sense of it until we really, really got it, exactly what we needed to know. And so after we did that, we started to work with a number of people all over the country and all over the world to help them find discharges. And the other thing that happened was once we invaded Iraq, we were getting many, many contacts from people who had gone AWOL from the Army and UA from the Marines and the Navy. And I was real clear with everyone that contacted me that I didn't care how they came to us or where they came from in the world, that we would counsel them as best we could, and there was no charge for our services. And I worked very closely with the Military Law Task Force, which is a branch of the National Lawyers Guild, to help them in case they did need a lawyer. Over 90% of our discharges never needed a lawyer, and we also have never had to deal with we've been able to negotiate out of every threatened court-martial, and we've only had one bad conduct, and that was from a case where the young man really misled us gravely because he was afraid of what would happen if he told us the truth. Had he told us his whole story, we would have probably been able to argue out of that at some point, but that was a very messy one. And at one instance that really keeps coming up for me was that we had a young man who, and I was trying to build trust in a community that had taken a stand in support of the invasion of Iraq. Our newspaper supported the invasion of Iraq. They interviewed people who just talked about what a hazard I was, having a dissenting opinion in their community and how dangerous that was. And so the fact that people would try and find me when they were AWOL or UA was a little worrisome to me because I didn't want that to draw attention to or increase their risk. And I had one young man who had called me from Fort Richardson in Alaska, and he was telling me that he was about to be deployed to Afghanistan. He had already done one tour. His post-traumatic stress was pretty extreme. He had little or no impulse control. He was homicidal and he was suicidal. He had made two attempts, and following the second suicide attempt, his command had said to him, "You can't do anything right. Next time you better succeed." And because of that, I did not tell him, you should leave the Army now. I listened and I talked to him about trends and what was going on with different commands. And that was it. That was the end of our conversation. Well, 3 days later, he walked into the Peace and Justice Center in Santa Rosa. And some people, volunteers were there, and they came in and they said, "There's a man out front. He looks very nervous." And so I walked out. And I walked up to him and I said, "So, what branch?" And he said, "How do you know?" And I said, "Well, the haircut's kind of a giveaway." But and he said, "Are you Elizabeth?" I said, "Yes." And he said, I talked to you from Fort Richardson." And I said, "Oh, welcome, blah, blah, blah." And I started to counsel him and work with him because there is a process in the military for Army who go AWOL that after a certain amount of days, they're dropped from the roles of their command. And once they're DFR'd, you can actually negotiate a turn-in and a release. But they have to go back under the custody of the Army for a short term, and sometimes for a longer term if there are extenuating circumstances or charges. So I started to work with this young man who was in very, very bad shape. And he was my third Sergeant Ryan, or Private Ryan. I had 93 Private Ryans in our number. It's a very popular name in the late 80s because there were many. They were just coming out of the woodwork. There were so many of them. And so he got a job at a mortuary in Petaluma. And he would go out and pick up the bodies. And the mortuary kept calling me and saying, he's the best employee we've ever had. No one ever lasted this job more than 2 weeks. He's just the best. And I said, well, I'm glad that you enjoy him. I'm glad he's safe, blah, blah, blah. And this went on, and I could not get him in the emotional state where he could turn himself in. He was very shaky, and he also, his anger was not that controllable. And I set up counseling for him with a therapeutic network that we've formed over the years that's very solid, and it's national. And most of the counseling is pro bono for people who need it. And his therapist was working very hard with him. Well, one day he got arrested. He was driving with a body. He just made a pickup, and he got pulled over, and they put him in the Sonoma County Jail. And Joe Benwell, who was the jail psychologist, calls me up. And I was actually at a Food Not Bombs meeting at Copperfield's bookstore, and the cell phone rings, and she says, what am I sitting with here? What's the story here? And I said, well, Ryan is homicidal, he's suicidal, he's special forces. And she said, oh, I'm not worried about that. I've taken his shoes and his shoelaces and his shirt. And I said, well, Joe, he's trained to take the life of anyone in the room within 4 minutes. I'm not sure you having his shoelaces is going to help. And if he gets too scared or he gets too nervous, he really could do some damage to himself or someone else. And she hung up on me. And so I went back to my Food Not Bombs meeting. I was sitting there talking to the kid about the next serving of the homeless. And the phone rings again, and it's Joe Benwell. And she says, come get him. And I said, let me guess. And she said, Elizabeth, just come get him. And I said, you called the Army, didn't you? And they won't come pick him up. And she said, come get him now. So I drove over to the Sonoma County Jail, picked him up, and as I'm driving away from the Sonoma County Jail with him, the Army calls
you.
Me and said, can you guarantee that he will turn himself in? And I said, I cannot guarantee you anything. I'll tell you what I'll advise him to do, but I will not guarantee you anything. And then I hung up. He turned himself in the following Monday at Fort Sill, Oklahoma. The following Friday, he was released with another than honorable. He's now happy here in San Diego, working, getting counseling, and he'll be okay. But there are thousands out there, and we need, as a culture that has to widen itself and react differently than we ever have to anything, we have to widen our hearts and find a way to hold this trauma that's coming home and to help it heal. I have especially strong feelings about this because so many of them who have come back, they've been real aggressive and real defensive in the beginning, you know, like, get out of my way, this is what I need to do, the Marines need me, you know, you're not a patriot, have come back and asked for help after enlisting. And the counter-recruiting is very important. That presence is very important. And the demilitarization needs to expand and grow because this is so different. They're actually getting over there and finding out that there's no rules of engagement. They're finding out that everything they were trained to do gets compromised in the illegality and the commission of war crimes. They're finding out that they're being ordered to fire across a narrow river and then going across the river and finding dead children. They're finding out over and over again that they've been lied to and that they're being traumatized. And this trauma is coming home. And I was just interviewed in El Salvador the other night by a evangelical man who had the big radio show down there, the big left radio show. And he was in the military in the 80s. And he said to me, I don't understand this, how this could be going on. And I said, you had a different commander-in-chief. And we really need to bear that in mind. This is a different time. We have to prepare a different way of accepting and healing and holding this crisis. And I'm sure that everyone here does what they can on a healing level. But we, all of us, collectively as communities of healthcare professionals all across the country, we need to heal this trauma and hold this trauma safely and securely. Thank you.
Thank you, Elizabeth.